So, let the spoiler horn ring out, for we are about to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming, which I saw this weekend. Jason, of course, has an episode of The Incomparable up, which you will undoubtedly be better than whatever Spider-Man-related nonsense I'm about to spew, because I haven't taken any notes when watching the movie, as I would usually do during a mic at the movies, so this is purely based upon me seeing this a couple of days ago. But I just wanted to talk about some of the things that I was excited about. You know, I said this before on the show, Spider-Man is and has always been my favorite superhero. I got Spider-Man fatigue with the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies. I just saw the first one of them, and I'd seen it too many times by then, and
yes.
I was just getting sad about it, honestly, because I love Spider-Man, and I felt like he wasn't being treated well enough. Because he's such a great hero, right? And appeals to so many people. One of the reasons that Sony picked him up and wouldn't let him go, right? And they kept trying to do it because, you know, at least those first ones, the first ones with Tobey Maguire, they were great, right? Like Spider-Man 1 and 2.
Yes.
Really great movies. And, you know, I think really, you know, set the stage for the ability to Marvel to do what they've done, because these Spider-Man movies were such a success.
Those original Spider-Man movies, because we just did a podcast about, it's not out yet, about Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. And Batman and Robin came out like 3 years before Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man. And Batman and Robin is literally like the stake through the heart of superhero movies. And then Spider-Man is the reinvigoration of superhero movies. And you could make a strong argument that Sam Raimi's Spider-Man is the movie that set the template and kicked off a modern wave of good superhero movies that we're still kind of living in. You know, you could argue it. It's not necessarily something that I would. I think it's debatable, but I think that it's possible, certainly, that it did that. Those first two Spider-Man movies are very good. Spider-Man 2 is frequently cited as one of the very best superhero movies ever made.
Yeah, I mean, even Spider-Man 3, which wasn't as good, was still pretty good, right? Like, but it was okay, right? Like, it was definitely the weaker of the three. Yeah. That had some really bad moments in it, but wasn't like an overall disaster, but like it just had some really dumb parts.
I think it was an overall disaster.
Okay,
much like
maybe,
Amazing Spider-Man 2. I think they were
maybe
both disastrous.
Maybe you've seen it more recently than me, right? Like, maybe this is what it is, and I'm looking at this with rose-tinted glasses. But the number one thing that I was worried about, and probably my number one favorite thing of this movie, is they were just like, origin story? What origin story?
There's literally a line where Peter's friend Ned says to him, "Dude, you were bitten by a radioactive spider." And he's like, "Yeah, I was. Well, you know, maybe get me that spider." And he says, "The spider's dead, dude. Like, leave it alone."
And so is Uncle Ben.
And there's no Uncle Ben. There's really literally a line where he says, after all that May has been through, mm-hmm. "I don't want to burden her with this." And that's it. That's the, you know, she's there. There's no uncle, and she's there alone. But that's it. It's not in there. And I, as a lifelong, there will be purists who will be like, but that's the core of the character. It's like, as a lifelong Spider-Man fan, good call. We don't need it. And instead, his origin story is essentially that he was in Civil War, which we all saw, Captain America Civil War.
Do you know, I haven't seen it. I don't know why. I thought I'd seen it.
the good news is it's a good movie. I liked it a lot. But the good news is, Mike, that the Spider-Man part gets recounted here at the beginning of Spider-Man
also,
Homecoming.
I mean, look, I've seen the trailer, so like I've also already seen it. Do you know what? Honestly, I think because I've seen the trailer, I thought I'd seen the movie. I don't know why this had happened to me, because I've seen all of them, right? I think
it's a good movie. Two,
I haven't seen Doctor Strange, and I haven't seen Civil War.
Also a good movie.
But like they're on my list, and so I'm going
to
watch them.
Time to get to those, yes, absolutely.
Well, something that was very exciting to me, this is the first Marvel movie that Edina has seen, other than the two Guardians of the Galaxy.
All right.
And we left this, and she was like, "I would watch some more." I'm like, "Great, there's loads of them." We'll go back to Iron Man, right? And so, I think we're going to maybe knock some of those out.
You should watch Doctor Strange with her. I think she would like that. I like that movie a lot.
Okay, good. Yeah, I know. Again, like I have only not seen it because I haven't seen it, not because I don't want to, if that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't require any real knowledge of any Marvel stuff, unlike Civil War, which totally does.
This was why I'd taken her to see Guardians of the Galaxy and took her to see this movie, because I figured Guardians of the Galaxy, especially because I knew that, but also even though I knew there would be some crossover with Spider-Man, that it wouldn't... We weren't going to see the Avengers all popping up for the entire movie where I had to explain like 15 characters to her, right?
Right.
But she's interested now in seeing the next Avengers movie because she liked Spider-Man, she liked Guardians of the Galaxy, she likes the idea of those characters all being in a movie together. Well, I'm like, well, we're going to have to watch more. Like, if you want to go and see that movie next year, you really need more backstory. So we're considering going through some of them. But so whilst we didn't get an origin story, we did get a really good parts of the movie of him learning his capabilities of Spider-Man. And this is all hidden up in the suit, right? Like, he knows how to be Spider-Man. He knows how to shoot webs. He knows how to climb walls. But what he doesn't know is what this suit can do for him, right? And I like how even throughout the whole movie, like, he's going through this because the suit continues to get more powerful. The suit gets more abilities. So he learns more. And it's done in a really great way, which I really liked. And the whole Karen voice, this is something that's new to me. I don't recall... Well, any comics that I've read, and this may be something that exists in some part of the comic book lore, I don't know of Spider-Man having a Jarvis-like assistant. I assume that somewhere throughout the whole Iron Man-like thing,
there is a brief moment in the comic book lore where Peter Parker gets a Tony Stark designed suit, which they call the Iron Spider. Yep. That this is kind of hinting at, but not really the same at all. I think the idea here is that movie viewers know that Iron Man has a suit that talks to him. And so if you're going to have Spider-Man be given a suit by Tony Stark, there is this assumption that maybe it's an Iron Man suit, essentially, which is what they play with when the kid hackers, which is a little bit ridiculous, disengage all the safety protocols and turn on the full span of the suit.
Yeah,
but I don't recall reading a story like this. Although my favorite thing about them having Tony Stark build him a suit is it explains how he could get a suit that looks so good, because that's never really well explained in Spider-Man lore. And it allows that they in Civil War they explain, like, he's got special, instead of wearing goggles, he's got these eye holes that can telescope and things like that. But what that does, that little trick, is it allows the movie Spider-Man suit to do what the comic book Spider-Man suit does, which is his eyes on his mask are expressive.
You can emote,
which makes sense in the comics, but when you try to do that in real life action, it doesn't work. Like, the physics of it doesn't work. It's all about, like, comic book artists adding expressivity to Spider-Man's mask. And so in this, they get it because they say it's a special high-tech suit that can adjust the eyes based on what Peter's doing inside the suit, which is, you know, whatever, it's tech explanation, you know, for magic things that happen. But in the end, it gives them the freedom to style the face of Spider-Man and have it be expressive even when he's in the suit, and it looks great. So that's a reason for it. The AI thing is not really taken from anywhere, but it's good because it shows he's totally out of his depth, and it's useful in the story because it gives him, at several points when he's alone, it gives him someone to talk to.
That's one of the reasons I really liked it. And, you know, I think they added just a different dimension, which I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really smart addition. I think the Iron Spider suit is what Tony has for him at the end of the movie, right? Like, that's what that is.
It's like a super souped up, super souped up suit.
Because it's also got the bigger golden spider on it, right? Which he, in the comics, I believe he gets like after Civil War, right? When they kind of align...
Yes, or during, I think it's maybe even during the Civil War or right before, and it's one of the reasons that Peter aligns with him in the comics. Yeah,
he gives him the cool suit.
So it sounds like that in the previews for that new Avengers movie, that this is that's where they're going with that, of like Tony trying to soup up what Spider-Man does. But I like that, in fact, at the end of the movie, one of the great things that happens is when Peter rejects Tony's, like, yep. we're going to have you move into the Avengers complex and just and not
test,
be a student,
right?
and not be a student anymore, and not yeah. be living at home with Aunt May, and I'll give you this super high tech suit, that he leaves. And I like that because we haven't even mentioned Michael Keaton yet, but I like that Michael Keaton, you know, he gives that speech that's a really great speech about, like, these guys don't care about us. We're the little guy. And he's not wrong. He's not wrong. He's a great villain speech because it is not like you listen to it and go, he's a madman. It's like, oh, I see why his worldview leads him to do what he does, which is a great, that's what I want from a villain, is I want a villain yeah. who makes sense. So he says that. And then when Peter turns down Tony, I cannot help but think of the echo of the Vulture speech, which is, you know, these guys, you're not like these people. You belong back in Queens. And I like that he gets his sort of regular suit back at the end. So he still gets, like, what Tony gave him originally, but not the super high-tech tricked-out Avengers thing that that he had He'll on display need. At the press conference.
Yeah, he's going to need that with Thanos, right? He'll need it, but right now he doesn't.
Right.
He
not
is
yet.
As Tony. I love that Tony did it, the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Like, I like the way they worked yep. that in. That was real nice. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's touch on Michael Keaton. Just one, I mean, amazing, right? Of course, the guy, you know, everybody knows
Fantastic.
He's going through a career renaissance right now, right? Which I guess started yeah. with Birdman.
Yeah,
you know, he's got, you know, he's one of those actors that, like, later in life has found a new level of success.
Every villain is the hero of their own story, and you see it with Michael Keaton. He is a hero. He takes the injustice mm-hmm. of having the government and Tony Stark take away his business, and he uses the alien tech that he scrounged to build a new business and buy a nice house and take care of his family, and then he reacts when the family is threatened. And he gives that speech. He is the hero of his own story. His motivations are reasonable. He is as realistic a villain as you're ever going to find in a superhero movie. And I love it.
Doesn't really feel like an intrinsically bad person. He's just a guy who does some things that are questionable, but the motives are decent.
He's made some bad decisions in the name of taking care of his family.
He kills someone by accident, right? Like, he kills that guy by accident.
Yeah, he does.
Which is
kind of
funny.
But doesn't seem too broken up about it, though. Yeah.
I know
to be
he's
honest.
Not, you know, because he's like, well, what are you going to do?
Yep.
And then, like, you know, he, because Peter saved his daughter's life, he won't kill him. Right? Won't kill him.
Right.
He's like, I'm going to let this go. Just don't come for me. And, you know, he's like, the plane doesn't have any humans on it, and he knows that, right? Like, the plane that he hijacks, and then obviously yep. right at the end of the movie, he effectively tries to save Peter's life because he saved
right.
his. Right? Like,
yes.
good man put in a bad situation does some bad things, right? Like that, and yep. that's what I really loved about the character, is this is not normal, because even in usual superhero movies, even if it's a regular person, which is how it tends to be now, that gets put into some kind of situation or something happens to them, they just become evil, right? And then that's just how they deal with their stuff.
Yep.
Right. Liz, I want to talk about Liz, because you tweeted something that intrigued me.
Right? I knew it would get you. Yeah,
you knew it was going to come for me. Mm-hmm. You compare Liz to Diane from Say Anything, and I would like you to expand
right.
on that a little bit.
Okay, so the background story is that the people who wrote this movie, including John Francis Daley, who played Linda Cardellini's little brother on Freaks and Geeks, which is kind of amazing, and Martin Starr, who is one of the other geeks in Freaks and Geeks, is in this movie as the science teacher, and the connections are amazing, because of course James Franco was in Freaks and Geeks, and he was Harry Osborn in the earlier Spider-Man movies, and Linda Cardellini from Freaks and Geeks is Hawkeye's wife in Age of Ultron. Oh, the connections are amazing. And one of the screenwriters of this movie is the kid brother. Anyway, they said that they modeled this movie after a John Hughes movie, especially The Breakfast Club. And you can totally see it. Like, the group of kids in the high school, like, The girl who we end up discovering is MJ.
Where everyone in my screening was like, oh, when that happened.
Yeah. She's so Ally Sheedy kind of, and you know, you got the popular girl and you got the kind of bully. And I mean, it is very, they said they were inspired by 80s movies, and I can feel it. And in fact, some of the reviews I've read, I don't entirely agree with this because I really liked all of it, but some of the reviews have said it's a fine superhero movie, but it's a great like high school movie, and I can see where they're coming from, because the high school stuff really lends, it makes this more than just another superhero movie. There is this whole other layer that is exactly what you want out of a Spider-Man movie, in my mind, is that other layer of his life as a regular high school student, and how does he balance them, and how does being Spider-Man kind of mess with his regular life. But the movie that I haven't seen cited, because it's not a John Hughes movie, and I just suddenly realized when I was editing The Incomparable, in fact, not even when we were talking about it, I made a reference to Say Anything in the movie or in the podcast and didn't take it the next step, which is Liz is like Diane Court in Say Anything in the sense that Diane in Say Anything loves her dad takes care of her, and she doesn't have a mom in this case, Liz has a mom, but loves her dad takes care of her. And everything in Diane's house is less than $10,000 in value because his dad is a tax cheat and an embezzler, and he gets sent to prison. And Liz lives in a nice house, and I made the joke on The Incomparable that it's a nice house, but everything in it costs less than $10,000 because Michael Keaton is a criminal, right? Yeah. And gets put in the pokey at the end of the movie. And that was that moment when I went, oh yeah, talk about another reference, intentional or not. But I had that moment where I thought, Liz is a brain. She's not a social outcast like Diane is, but she's a brain. She's the captain of the academic decathlon team that wins the national championship, right? It's the most important thing in her life. So although she's beautiful and looks like she would probably be the most beautiful person at the arts and magnet school, she's still a nerd. Really, and her dad is somebody she loves and who takes care of her, but is actually a criminal and lets her whole family down while he thinks he's taking care of the family. And the immediate reference I got was to Diane from Say Anything, because it felt like the same sort of story. So yeah,
you're right. And I really, as you can imagine, I love the Liz character, right? Because
web slinging
in my brain,
sport of the future.
Just, yeah, it's there. You mentioned character Michelle, who at the end of the movie says she goes by MJ, which is just so good. And also just like the attitude of that character is not Mary Jane, and she is not red hair,
right?
Like, I love that. I love all of that. I love everything they're doing there.
The message they're sending is, you think you know about Spider-Man stock characters, but you don't. We're going to do some different stuff, and don't expect what, you know, don't expect a redheaded girl to walk in and say, face a chapter, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's great.
I like the mix with the Miles Morales story arc, with the inclusion of the Ned character.
Yeah, because Ned is basically Gank from Miles Morales' story, which is a slightly portly Asian teenager who is his friend and confidant and knows that he's Spider-Man. That is right out of the Miles Morales storyline, and it's a great character, and it's great to give him a confidant. And of course, at the end, Aunt May finds out he's Spider-Man too. And this is that's all right out of the Ultimate Spider-Man stories about Peter and Miles. And I think that's great, because Peter on his own, only knowing as the only person who knows he's Spider-Man, is kind of boring. I don't really want him to be known by everybody, but having a bunch of people who know him and support him leads to better drama, I would say, and a more modern take on it. If you think about Ultimate Spider-Man or something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, having, you know, Team Spider-Man is a, I think, a better approach to it.
And the casting, I mean, throughout is great, right? Marissa Tomei, fantastic Aunt May. Donald Glover played a great role in the movie.
Yeah, he's in really two scenes, and after the first scene, I was really sad that he wasn't coming back, and then he came back for a great scene where he just wants to get home with his groceries, and he's been webbed to his car.
Yeah.
And he gives a nice lecture to Spider-Man, where he's like, you need to be better at this part of your job, because he's a kid and he has no idea what he's doing. And the Easter egg there is that Donald Glover's character that he's playing is, and the reason that he's in the first scene trying to get some sort of like thieving equipment. He doesn't want weapons. He wants like things that let you stick to walls and stuff, is because his character is in the Marvel canon known as the Prowler. He's Aaron Douglas, I think I want to say his name is. He's the Prowler. And at one point he mentions to Spider-Man in that second scene, you're from Queens. My nephew lives in Queens. His nephew is Miles Morales.
That is awesome.
Yeah,
that
little tidbit. Little
awesome. That's really interesting. Do you reckon I'm going to do something with that?
I don't know. Who knows? Some things are just Easter eggs, and if they go with them. I think the interview I read with the screenwriters basically said, they're like, did you have a plan for the second movie and putting these things in there? And they're like, you know what? Is there going to be a second movie? Are we going to work on the second movie? What do they want from the second movie? He's like, I get the impression that you put in that stuff as potential threads or fun Easter eggs, and you just shrug. I don't think there's a master plan yet. Now, this movie having done very well, maybe they will bring these writers back and maybe they will pick up some of those threads. But I don't think they wrote this with a plan for what the second of these Spider-Man movies would be. I don't think so. It's just, I do think that is a fun tip of the cap to Miles Morales, and I like that. And plus, they use the Ned character is right out of Miles' story, which is fun.
Yeah, and I also just thought that John Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. played their parts perfectly without overshadowing Tom Holland. I think that they fit into the story well.
How many dads does he have, since he doesn't have a dad? He has John Favreau, who like is sort of his babysitter more than a dad, but he mm-hmm. gives, you know, he's the one he's trying to get approval from. Robert Downey Jr. is this remote dad who he can't get to, and then he's got Michael Keaton, who's his villain dad, who
He has money dad, he has babysitter dad.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Teacher dad. And
in the end, he, despite what we've seen from the beginning, which is being starstruck by Robert Downey Jr., by Tony Stark, he goes back home, and I like that. I like that choice. That maybe not everything is the Avengers, even if he will totally be in the next Avengers movie. Like the idea that he's not going to become Tony Stark's superhero university enrollee number one, right? He's going to go be a regular kid and live a normal life and be Spider-Man, and he makes that choice. I really like that too. But Downey is good, and it is a funny gag when Pepper Potts opens the door and it turns out there was a press conference and it wasn't a test, and that was pretty funny because I assumed it was a test, and just as Peter did. But I do think there was maybe a little too much Downey. Like maybe the scenes could have been shorter, and the last scene where it's just him and Pepper, it was unnecessary. We talked about this on The Incomparable, but I got a sense from it that a little bit of insecurity from Sony and from Marvel, frankly, that they needed a lot of Downey in the movie in order to prop it up and make it feel like a Marvel movie. And in the end, they didn't, but they didn't know that.
I can see the feeling of necessity just to like really drive home the point that this is a different Spider-Man and Spider-Man is now a part of this world. And like, you know, ideally have a few different characters. Why do you think Chris Evans is in it a bunch, right? Like just, you know, just do what you can to show that Spider-Man is a part of this world.
And the plot is about garbage left over from the Avengers Battle of New York, right? That's in there at the beginning as a fairly easy, like with the Daredevil and other Netflix TV shows that have that as a backdrop of we're down on the ground in New York City, but remember when there was this thing, remember the fallout from when they had this battle in the middle of New York. They continue to mine that without you really needing to know the continuity other than there was a disaster and a bunch of alien garbage got left everywhere.
Yeah, like, I mean, there was this one fight one time, like, that was so many years ago, and, like, the Iron Man 3 built on it, right? Like, this movie's built on it, as you say, like, the Daredevil's, like, it's all building on it. It's kind of funny in a way that, like, and I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm only going to assume that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is partly based on the fact that there was this fight in New York. Like, it is kind of funny, like, when you think about superhero movies in general, about the fact that there are always fights in New York. And there was just this one time, and then like it's so many more movies are pulling from it. Like if you think of the DC universe, New York has been like destructed like a billion times over by now.
It's not even New York. It's like Metropolis and Gotham and whatever. It's sort of a fictionalized, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. But yeah, anyway, I'm just thinking like the Superman movies, right? Like they just keep getting, Metropolis just keeps getting flattened, which is kind of funny. So, yeah, this is a quick thing. When we left the movie, Dina was like, we should see Wonder Woman 2. I'm assuming that this is a good choice, right? Like, people seem to really like that movie, because I just said to her, like, you know, I wasn't initially enthused to see it because everything else I've seen from the DC universe I haven't enjoyed. But would you recommend Wonder Woman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, unabashedly, and you don't need to know anything about. Here's what you need to know about other DC movies before you see Wonder Woman. Bruce Wayne met Wonder Woman once, and she had a picture of people from World War One. That's it. You didn't really need to know that because it's in the opening sequence. But that's it. Like, literally, the one thing you need to know is immediately recapped, and the rest of the movie happens, and you don't need to know.
Yeah, because initially I just naturally assumed I wasn't going to enjoy it because I hadn't enjoyed any of the other post good Batmans, you know, like past that Batman trilogy. You know, I didn't like Superman, Man of Steel. So I just figured I just wouldn't enjoy it. But it seems like that Wonder Woman's at least broken that curse for the time being.